Okay, over to you, Francis.
All righty. Okay, hang on. I want to turn off something before we get going here. Turn off my phone here. Okay. Yeah, that should do it for us. Good. Okay. So, welcome to this 73rd and last webinar on the Sacred Teachings of All Ages by Manly P. Hall. I think we just passed the 6 year mark last time, and that's pretty good. We got a ways into the book, and I'm really excited about what's coming next. Starting next month, I'll be hosting a new series during this same time slot on Light of the Soul, the only book that DK co-authored with Alice Bailey. As you probably know, AAB authored a number of books on her own, and for the rest of the Blue Book, she acted as an amanuensis for DK, except for Light of the Soul. In this book, DK dictated an esoteric paraphrasing of the Sutras of Patanjali. AAB then wrote her commentary, and finally, DK reviewed and adjusted her commentary to ensure that what she said aligned with the intended esoteric meaning. So it was a unique collaboration. So in this work, the Christ and Patanjali are presented as archetypes of perfected soul expression, whereas the Christ's role was to embody the perfected soul in manifestation. Patanjali's role was to codify the ancient oral teachings into the Yoga Sutras, which became foundational for the Trans-Himalayan school and theosophy, really formed the basis of the Blue Books. This series will start next month, January 4th, fittingly on the first Sunday of the new year. So I really hope you'll all join BL and I for the series. I'm really looking forward to it. Okay, so for this very last secret teaching, it's ironic we have 20 people. Okay, for this very last Secret Teaching of All Ages session, we'll take a look at the chapter entitled "The Wonders of Antiquity." So we'll start with a caption under the frontispiece entitled "Consulting the Oracle of Delphi." Could we get a reader for this, please?
I'll start us off. While the tripod and its base is here shown differ from the description of several authors, an attempt has been made to follow as closely as possible symbolism concealed within the allegory of the oracle. The Delphic mysteries use the oracle as their chief symbol, and it is the spiritual esoteric mystery rather than the historical and consequently unimportant aspect with which the student of symbolism is interested. While the spirit inhabiting the fumes, which rose continuously from the fissure, entered into the body of the priestess, the tripod vibrated as though struck severe and repeated blows. Loud clangings were heard, which echoed through the cavern. The din increased as the control of the demon over the priestess became more complete, and the rattling and crashing did not cease until the spirit released its hold upon the Pythia. The three legs of the tripod symbolized the three periods of time controlled by Apollo, namely the past, the present, and the future. The space enclosed by the legs of the tripod formed the sacred Pythagorean tetrahedron with the prophetess seated upon its apex, as the priestess of Delphi is held aloft over the abyss of the oracle, supported only by three slender legs ending in claws. So the spiritual nature of man is suspended over the abyss of oblivion by three golden threads of divine power. The face of Apollo peers upon the tripod, and around the base are coiled serpents, which symbolize Python, whose decaying body lies beneath the Delphic shrine.
Okay, first, while the tripod and its base, as here shown, differ from the description of several authors, in other words, it didn't look like this, an attempt has been made to follow as closely as possible the symbolism concealed within the allegory of the oracle. So, many ancient authors, including Herodotus, Plutarch, Strabo, and Pausanias, wrote about the oracle at Delphi, which became active in the 8th century BC and continued until 393 AD, though its peak influence was between the 8th and 4th centuries BC. During this 400-year period, the oracle was highly sought after for prophecies and advice on all kinds of things, including wars, political decisions. Its influence began to decline after the Roman conquest of Delphi in the early 2nd century BC, and it eventually ceased operations in 393 AD when the Roman Emperor Theodosius I banned all pagan practices, right? It was basically his name has come up a lot of times during this series, and he really, it was the death knell of the mystery schools of the Greeks and the entire Mediterranean area. These images are from, these two images are from 330 BC, so just before, right during, just after, I should say, just after its peak. Right, so very much when it was still quite influential, these images appeared on the coins and in a fresco. So let's take a look at two passages, both written when the oracle was still functioning. The first is from Strabo's Geographica. Yes, Tia.
Before we delve into the writings or the communications of the Oracle of Delphi, I would assume to go back to the original frontispiece that you brought out.
Mm-hmm.
Could we return to that?
Sure. Hang on. That one, right?
Right. And when I see here, it says, while the spirit inhabiting the fumes, which rose continuously from the fissures, entered the body of the priestess. I point to that because I'm sure that there's a lot of glamour surrounding the concept of the Oracle of Delphi.
Oh,
and the
sure.
Yeah, and so the symbolism of rising from the fires may be actually, as Michael would say, many people assume that there are spirits, used to say that he would assume, people assume that spirits are communicating, and really the person has gotten to access to a certain aspect of their soul or their intuition.
I like that. Yeah.
So when I see this in that particular sentence, maybe we have someone who had, I wouldn't say she was or he were on the intuitive plane, but probably had access to some soul awareness, which they had activated and was bringing through, as opposed to this concept of spirits.
Yeah, it's a very interesting alternative theory to this idea of the fumes rising, which then put this priestess of Delphi. She was a committed to this discipline, and that what they call the daemon, which is not a demon. A daemon is a benevolent being out of form that then channels through her. So, but yeah, I like that idea. And it could be a combination too. It could be that that to be able to do this work that she was able to do, which was to be receptive and sensitive to the impressions of, a higher being, would also require the kind of spiritual work that we normally relate to closing the gap between personality and soul. So, yeah, good
Well,
thoughts.
just an addendum on that, and I know you'll like this. I would say one way of viewing the oracle is a seer, and we know that DK definitely said that in order to be a seer, you had to have a certain amount of purification. I think be a vegetarian for at least 7 years prior to that to purify the vehicles. So, so there, and also, I mean, she was part of a temple priestess or a group of people who would also have supported her with a collective consciousness. I just say that to say because sometimes I think we can get too caught up in the glamour, of this Oracle of Delphi and know that, there does, we still have oracles of Delphi in a sense. We can all be that. Once we access our soul awareness.
Yeah, that's well said.
And
Okay.
Veronica was next, so.
And Veronica.
Plato used to call the soul the demon.
Well, there you go. That it's oh, it's yeah, or daemon. Yeah,
Demonio.
I think
So
DA. Go ahead.
Demonio, he used to say demonio, and I think the word demon comes from that. But he used to talk about the soul with that word, saying the demon in me, but not the demon the way we understand the demon today. He was
Right.
talking about the soul.
Gotcha. Yeah. I want to, let's see. I'm going to do a speech thing for this.
Demon.
Yeah. So DAEMON is pronounced like demon, right? But of course has a different meaning than the same word without the AE, which is not surprising, which is
In Greek,
more
it's
fun.
called demonio.
I don't really
Demonio.
monio. Okay.
Demonio.
I don't know that word.
That's the demon. Demon,
Okay.
he says here. Demonio, it's a Greek word.
Okay. Interesting, huh? Because we have this Christianized version which has taken a many sacred ideas and made them a part of the underworld. And here's another example, right, where the demon is a follower of the devil, kind of a thing. Okay, let me get back to full screen version here.
But Francis, this makes sense with what everybody has been saying because if it means the soul and the sorry, Aunt Veronica, I can't say it right, the demon within, well, that's the personality that obscures the soul. So it's just a matter of interpretation of the various different texts that came down and then the telephone game. With each telling, it becomes a different spin.
Yeah, we've had so many interpretations, and if you look back on the etymology of these words, it's really fascinating because they come from really unexpected sources often, and then have been co-opted by different religions to mean different things. You know, here's just sorry, I'm adjusting the window here. I think that's better. Get back there. Here we go. I think Barbara's hand was up.
Yes, go ahead, please, Barbara.
Yes. Well, I think that at this time in history, Pythagoras was consulting with Apollo on the nature of the cosmos, of aspects of reality that might be beyond even the soul's recognition. And so it was still a time when some of the gods, such as Hermes, were still guiding humanity, and playing a very, very significant role through the Eleusinian mysteries. And seeding in some way the whole Platonic world.
Well said. Yeah, that's really right. You have to remember this started, you know, before the historical dates that are usually ascribed to Pythagoras. This oracle was 800 BC. You know, I think Pythagoras is usually put in the 7th century BC. So this would have been around for all the historically known Greek you could even call them avatars, you know, great teachers, masters of wisdom, certainly. So, yeah. Thank you, Barbara. Anyone else? Okay, so we're.
Yes, Tia has her hand up again. Go ahead, Tia.
I think I have a thought about that. Again, Plato as an avatar consulting Apollo, we could say that would be the sun. Hermes could also be representative of Mercury. We were in a time very much when man was anthropomorphic. And so they had to use form to enshroud these cosmic concepts. Because they had not, dealt with even the higher aspects of the abstract mind, but a very few. And so as humanity evolves, and this is more and more accessible to the collective, I think we'll see some of these concepts of deity have to be redefined and re-understood.
Yeah, it was totally appropriate to the Taurian age, which was you went to a great being like the Oracle, who was channeling a greater being, in order to receive inspiration, information, instruction, etc., rather than yourself going through the discipline of becoming. Which is really more of a process that emerged in the, except for the priesthood, emerged later in the Piscean age. So yeah, I was just noticing here that, you know, this serpent is very much like a uraeus here, and that universally stands for an enlightened one, sort of in support of your idea, Tia, that you know, this. It suggests the risen Kundalini and of direct contact with the source through one's own efforts, you know, through the efforts made, one has achieved enlightenment. And that's typically what this means. It's interesting that it's shown here. Also, I didn't really inspect this before. You have the duality, the serpents of the lower serpents of dualism, which she has transcended with this singular serpent. So it's quite interesting. Okay, let's see. Okay, so let's take a look at these passages. This first one's, like I said, it was literally written during the time that the Delphi was still in operation. The Delphic Oracle. Could we get a reader, please?
Tia, can you read that for us, please?
The place where the oracle is delivered is said to be a deep hollow
Ah, go ahead.
cavern the entrance to which is not very wide. From it rises up an exhalation which inspires a divine frenzy. Over the mouth is placed a lofty tripod on which the Pythian priestess ascends to receive the exhalation, after which she gives the prophetic response in verse or prose. The prose is adapted to measure by poets who are in the service of the temple. Phemone is said to have been the first Pythian prophetess, and both the prophetess and the city obtained their appellation from the word pithistai, to inquire. Strabo's Geographica, Book 9.
Thank you. Okay, and the second quote is from Herodotus. His writings called the Histories. Can we get a reader, please?
And Veronica, can you read that one for us, please?
Once upon a time, the land of Epidavros would bear no crops, and the Epidavrians sent to consult the oracle of Delphi concerning their affliction. The answer bade them set up the images of Adamia and, or I'm sorry, Auxesia, and promise them better fortune when they should be done. Shall the images be made of bronze or stone? The Epidavrians asked, but the Pythia replied, "Oh, neither, but let them be made of the garden olive." Then the Epidavrians sent to Athens and asked leave to cut olive wood in Attica, believing that the Athenian olives to be the holiest, or according to the others, because there were no olives at that time anywhere else in all the world but in Athens. The Athenians answered that they would give them leaves, but on condition, would give them leave, but on condition on their bringing offerings year by year to Minerva Polias and the Erechtheus. The Pythagoreans agreed, and having obtained what they wanted, made the images of olive wood and set them up to their own country. Henceforth, the land bore its crops, and they duly paid the Athenians what had been agreed upon. Herodotus, Histories.
Thank you, Anne Veronica. Okay, so this gives us just a really valuable example of the kind of intercourse that went on between the oracle and the priesthood and priestess of Delphi and the world in general. There's probably 1,000 stories like this one, Okay. Next, the Delphic mysteries used to the oracle as their chief symbol. And it is a spiritual, esoteric mystery rather than the historical and consequently unimportant aspect with which the student of symbolism is interested. Okay. The Pythian or Delphic mysteries was a religious institution dedicated to the god Apollo, which played a significant role in ancient Greek religion and culture. In fact, Delphi was a major center of worship and pilgrimage, attracting visitors from all over Greece and beyond. I was lucky enough to go there. And it's in an extraordinary setting, as you can see here. As with the other Greek mystery schools, almost nothing is known about its interstructure or teachings, because it was secret, that information, but it was not published. But we can gain some insight into its purpose through this passage from Faber's Dissertations of the Mysteries of the Cabiri. Quote, "The Greeks had a similar notion of Delphi being the navel of the world. The idea originated from a misconception of the sacred term Omphiale, the oracle of the solar god, which the Greeks perverted to Omphalos and the Latins into Umbilicus. Delphi is a word of the very same import, being compounded of Telfi, the oracle of the sun. Next. While the spirit inhabiting the fumes, which rose continuously from the fissure, entered into the body of the priestess, the tripod vibrated as though struck severe and repeated blows. Loud clangings were heard, which echoed through the cavern. The din increased as the control of the demon over the priestess became more complete, and the rattling and crashing did not cease until the spirit released its hold upon the Pythia. So, MPH bases this imaginative narrative on a number of sources. In Plutarch's essay on the E at Delphi, the author describes the vapors rising from the chasm, followed by the priestess entering into a trance-like state, and that the vapors were believed to be the source of her prophetic powers. Strabo mentions the sweet odor of the vapors and how they affected the Pythia. However, no author mentions a vibrating or clanging tripod. And you think they would, right? It's that would be such a notable feature. So you wonder. Gerald Massey has an interesting theory as to the source of the vapors. Quote, Lucian asserts that a virgin delivered the oracle at Delphi, whence the symbolic constellation Virgo, and a dragon spoke from under the tripod because of the constellation Draco among the stars. The tripod was a form of the tree of knowledge. 1 minute. Albert Pike seems to affirm this, saying simply, Python, the serpent deity, was esteemed oracular, and the tripod at Delphi was a triple-headed serpent of gold. Next. The three legs of the tripod symbolize the three periods of time controlled by Apollo, namely the past, present, and the future. The space enclosed by the legs of the tripod forms the sacred Pythagorean tetrahedron with the prophetess seated upon its apex. Okay, so the idea that the three legs of the tripod represent the past, present, and future does align with Apollo's role as a god of prophecy, since Apollo, through the Pythia, provided insights into all three time periods, right? The oracular visions or utterances, the subject matter for those, well, came from the past, the present, and the future. The tetrahedron formed by the enclosed space of the tripod, so the so-called enclosed space by the tripod, is a three-dimensional shape with four triangular faces, which, if MPH's theory on the meaning of the three legs of the tripod is correct, symbolizes the interconnectedness of the tripart nature of time, you know, past, present, and future. However, this is pure speculation on the MPH's part, as none of the surviving Greek tripods form a tetrahedron. But who knows? In order to give stability to the oracle seat, a tripod more like what is here pictured would be needed. I mean, you can't really see her sitting on something like this, you know, even if it was. Well, I suppose it was very large, but it just seems that the tripod aspect would work better. But we just don't know. There's literally no firsthand descriptions of the tripod. Next, as the priestess of Delphi is held aloft over the abyss of the oracle, supported only by three slender legs ending in claws, so the spiritual nature of man is suspended over the abyss of oblivion by three golden threads of divine power. So MPH at its best, right? As mentioned before, the three legs of the tripod as past, present, and future make sense, but the three golden threads of divine power probably refers to Atma, Buddhi, Manas, without which we would indeed fall into oblivion. So, you know, it's very much after the fact, but it's philosophically sound to, you know, make the analogy.
Francis?
Yeah.
We have a couple of comments here.
Sure.
Aunt Veronica says, Greece is full of olive trees, and it is interesting that there weren't any in Epidaurus at the time. And then Ben adds to that, and he says they may be referring to the super special olive tree of Athena. Her entire temple is built off kilter to accommodate her tree. The olive tree at the temple of Athena, the erection on the Acropolis of Athens, is sacred, the very spot where Athena planted the first olive tree during her contest with Poseidon for the patronage of Athens. And then Anne Veronica says, if you throw a coin in the middle of the theater of Epidavros, you can hear it in the last row.
Wow. Okay. Great comments. First of all, we don't know how many olive trees were, you know, around at that time. I tend to go with Ben's idea that they were looking for the most sacred representation of olive tree-ness, right? And so they went to Attica in order to gain their olive branch. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Oh, sorry, Tia, go ahead, please.
It's really interesting. I'm reflecting upon your comment, Francis, that this happened during the age of Taurus. And you know, the whole theory or the whole esoterically is illumination and the opening up the brow center.
Actually, you know what? I misspoke. I'm realizing now it really was the age preceding Pisces, which would be the age of Aries.
Okay.
The roots of all this, which would have been in Egypt's second kingdom, would have been the age of Taurus. But no, actually, the time of, you know, the halcyon time of the oracle would have been in Aries. So sorry about that.
No, it doesn't discount my comment, though.
Okay.
Because even so, the focus here we see is on a lot of the material aspects. All of these concepts that we're talking about are deep spiritual initiate concepts, but they're being put into form.
Yeah.
So that the collective can understand it. But the reality is that even though there's this effort to, because there's this focus on God transcendent and not God immanent at this time.
Right.
So we need to have these daemons and all of these other things. The fact is that many people who came to the Oracle of Delphi came for personal reasons.
Right.
And that psychism, that's not intuition.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm yeah, you know, it would just be great to know more, wouldn't it? You know, did they screen the applicants? Was there a deeply esoteric school somehow in, as part of the Delphi tradition, which would have been other than, you know, the run-of-the-mill questions that came forth? Did they screen the questions? You know, it's there's so many. It would be just wonderful to know more about it. It was around for so long. You know, we're talking about 1,200 years. You know,
I know that a lot of the kings would consult the Oracle of Delphi because they would have access to her.
so that would have been almost certainly all about, you know, political moves,
Exactly.
power-based stuff. So I'm sure the nobles too had greater access than the hoi polloi, you know. But you know, you have to wonder, did any students of mysticism or occultism ask for higher truths, or was that just not what was she was about? It's we don't know, you know. Okay. Finally, the face of Apollo appears upon the tripod in this version, and around the base are coiled serpents to symbolize Python, whose decaying body lies beneath the Delphic shrine. This suggests that the fumes are a result of a decaying body of the Python, which, since the Delphic Oracle was active for around 1,200 years, seems unlikely. I mean, that there's a physical interpretation to this, it just doesn't really hold. In fact, this is, you know, J.A. Knapp's, this artist who illustrated the entire Secret Teachings of All Ages. This is just his interpretation there. We don't have direct descriptions of anything about the physicality of the oracle. So we just don't know. More to the point, this serpent is an incorporeal serpent of wisdom who, as intimated by Gerald Massey, magically informs the fumes. And I could agree with that. I could see how that could be a magical process, right? That there would be some great being whose aspect was as a serpent of wisdom who informed these fumes. We just don't know. Okay, opposite this frontispiece, yes, Tia.
Say that if you have a collective consciousness that has not awakened to the fact of God imminent, it would lend more credence to what you're saying if you attribute your knowledge to some great deity as opposed to your soul, because nobody would even have a concept of how powerful that is.
That's right. We just don't know. There's such an adherence to the idea of certain basic concepts, you know, one of them being these fumes, this cave, this tripod, and this priestess, that, you know, to discount the methodology altogether. And unless it was all just a giant front for, you know, like a device so that it would be believable. I mean, that's, you know.
Well, I mean I think so. It doesn't, I mean, I think that you can use form to represent mystical truths that people can't access. And so I can't necessarily tell you that the soul is that you have a soul and it has love, will, and power, but I can give you a tripod, right?
Right.
And I can't necessarily let you know that the divine feminine aspect is the or the matriarchal line is where intuition was usually passed on in these priestesses and in these groups. But I can give you an Oracle of Delphi who says that she is in connection to a higher deity.
Right.
So I'm not saying that they didn't have these fumes rising, but I also understand the importance of ritual, and they can use ritual as a form to help people connect that don't have that concept within themselves.
That's
So,
right. Yeah, I think that's right on. It's just, we just don't know the degree of causality, you know, like the, I would say, you know, the tripod, the cave, and the priestess are all like a huge altar, really, you know, which is symbolic of the higher truths. The where we may be crossing the line and we just don't know is the idea of this demon informing the fumes. How much of that is was causal, we just simply don't know. Okay. So I,
Francis,
yeah.
sorry. Ben says recent geological and archaeological studies confirm that ethylene and other hydrocarbon gases seep from fault lines beneath the Temple of Apollo at Delphi. The tripod, the three golden threads of divine power, and the three windows in DK's workroom in our visualizations, Atma, Buddhi, Manas.
Yeah,
So
I'm reading that here.
within.
So within, yeah, isn't that interesting? It just seems too singular to have made up that there were that these, you know, that they made up these fumes. I can't buy that. I think they existed, and you know, here we have confirmation. The next step would, to see if they have any influence on your consciousness, you know.
Well, the thing is, Francis, I mean, but probably the answer is more obvious. You could choose the cave because it had these gases coming out of it. It doesn't mean that you, in your consciousness, caused the gases to come out of it. You simply could have chosen that spot for that reason.
Oh,
I
sure.
mean, you know, what I'm saying is, I'm not saying that this did not happen and that there was a very spiritual, ritualistic purpose for it all, but I'm saying that there's a lot of glamour around it, and that you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Does the consciousness come first and the altar, or
Right.
does the altar bring the consciousness?
Yeah,
That was the question.
yep. And right. And what was the interface, you know, between the outer, the whole phenomenon of the of this place, the interface between that and the source of the information, you know, which obviously proved to be effective over and over and over again. So that's pretty much a given. So yeah. Okay. Opposite the frontispiece is the first page of the chapter entitled Wonders of Antiquity. So what we're going to do is just read, you know, for this last session in the Secret Teachings, we're just going to read into this chapter and I will comment as we go. But you'll find that a lot of this is, there's not really all that much comment that is necessary, but it's quite interesting material. So let's start with this first couple of paragraphs, please, for reader.
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Wonders of Antiquity. It was the common practice among the early Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans to seal lighted lamps in the sepulchres of their dead as offerings to the god of death. Possibly, it was also believed that the deceased could use these lights in finding his way through the valley of the shadow. Later, as the custom became generally established, not only actual lamps, but miniatures of them in terracotta were buried with the dead. Some of the lamps were enclosed in circular vessels for protection, and instances have been recorded in which the original oil was found in them in a perfect state of preservation after more than 2,000 years. There's ample proof that many of these lamps were burning when the sepulchres were sealed, and it has been declared that they were still burning when the vaults were opened hundreds of years later. The possibility of preparing a fuel which would renew itself as rapidly as it was consumed has been a source of considerable controversy among the medieval authors. After due consideration of the evidence at hand, it seems well within the range of possibility that the ancient priest chemists did manufacture lamps that burned, if not indefinitely, at least for considerable periods of time. Numerous authorities have written on the subject of ever-burning lamps. W. Wynne Westcott estimates the number of writers who have given the subject consideration is more than 150, and H.P. Blavatsky is 173. While conclusions reached by different authors are at variance, a majority admit the existence of these phenomenal lamps. Only a few maintained that the lamps would burn forever. But many were willing to concede that they might remain alight for several centuries without replenishment of the fuel. Some considered the so-called perpetual lights as mere artifices of the crafty pagan priests, while a great many, admitting that the lamps actually burned, made the sweeping assertion that the devil was using this apparent miracle to ensnare the credulous and thereby lead their souls to perdition. You know, I wanted to say a bit, just a minute, about glamour, because at that time there was a serious attempt to integrate science, trade, culture, the heavens, the skies, the stars. So it strikes me that the glamour often lies in the interpreter rather than the practices themselves. They were using, you know, what they knew in magical ways. And I'm always stunned by the creativity of the people at that time attempting to understand the world. It was kind of phenomenal, it seems to me.
Yeah, it's a really good point that so often it's set up, you know, by a master as a pure magical form, and it's glamorized by those who interpret what they're seeing in different ways. You know, it's the human condition, right? We love a great story, we love miracle stories. Yeah, and so the glamour arose more from the participants than from those who originally set up these altars, wherever they may be. Okay.
Francis?
Yeah.
We got a couple of comments here. A little earlier, Vivian said, we can imagine that they needed to raise the priestess above the direct fumes as they could have been poisonous and hot. And then Anne Veronica says, we still light candles at the graves.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. And, you know, Anne Veronica being a citizen of Greece, so it's direct continuance, right? Okay. First, it was a common practice among the early Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans to seal lighted lamps in the sepulchres of their dead as offerings to the god of death. Possibly it was also believed that the deceased could use these lights in finding their way through the valley of the shadow. So in all three cultures, Egyptian, Greeks, and Romans, light symbolized the presence of the gods and the hope for a safe passage through the underworld. Ultimately, this light is symbolic of the inner light of the spirit, the only light that can truly guide us towards reunion with the soul. There are a couple of references that can help us better understand the nature of this light. The first is the ninth arcanum of the Tarot, called the Hermit, who holds a lighted lamp aloft to guide those who follow in his footsteps. This arcanum is associated with Virgo, where the light in the dark night suggests the gestating Christ light, as symbolized by Virgo's esoteric ruler, the moon veiling Vulcan. Could we get a reader for this?
Yes, Scott, can you read that for us, please?
Back. There we go. The lighted lamp he holds high above his head is the light of knowledge, the lamp of truth, or the word. That is, thy word shall be a light to my path and lamp unto my feet. It is this inner illumination of one who has come off victor. Just as in his early steps, the light shone above him as the star of initiation, which he had to follow over deserts, morasses, and desolate regions without losing sight of it. Even though at times the dark mists of earth hid it from view, so it is still the light from the one master, his own immortal self, of which we read. The light from the one master, the one unfading light of spirit, shoots its effulgent beams on the disciple from the very first. Its rays thread through the thick, dark clouds of matter. Now here, now there, these rays illuminate. Like sun sparks light the earth through the thick foliage of the jungle growth. But, O disciple, unless the flesh is passive, head cool, the soul is firm and pure as flaming diamond, the radiance will not reach the chamber, the center of spiritual consciousness. Its sunlight will not warm the heart. The hermit has let the light reach the chamber of his heart. He has also made it shine in the chamber or center of spiritual consciousness. Hence the symbol of the light being placed in the lantern, that is no longer fitful like a distant star, but in his conscious grasp, ready to guide him every step of the way.
So if you're looking for a book on the Tarot, it's hard to do better than The Key to the Universe. It's a two-volume set. It's really inspired writing by Curtis. I think it was a husband and wife team that wrote these two books. Okay. The other reference is a statement about Diogenes. Quote, I love this. He lit a lamp in broad daylight and said, as he went about, I'm looking for a human being. So again, the idea of the penetrating light that reveals the spirit aspect, right? Okay, next. Later, as the custom became generally established, not only actual lamps, but miniatures of them in terracotta were buried with the dead. Some of the lamps were enclosed in circular vessels for protection, and instances have been recorded in which the original oil was found in them in a perfect state of preservation after more than 2,000 years. Pardon me for just a second. The miniature lamps indicate that those who placed them recognized that they were symbolic, a form of magical talisman intended to stimulate the vision of the deceased, right? Open the eyes of the deceased, right? To protect them from evil spirits and to enhance the wearer's power and authority in the afterlife. Enclosing a talisman in a circular vessel protected and enhanced its magical properties and extended the talisman's longevity. All subjective magical ideas connected with these lamps. Next. There is ample proof that many of these lamps were burning when the sepulchres were sealed, and it has been declared that they were still burning when the vaults were opened hundreds of years later. The possibility of preparing a fuel of which would renew itself as rapidly as it was consumed has been a source of considerable controversy among medieval authors. After due consideration of the evidence at hand, it seems well within the range of possibility that the ancient priest chemist did manufacture lights that burned, if not indefinitely, at least for a considerable period of time. Okay, so the only way a lamp sealed in a sepulcher could continue burning for centuries is through some magical alchemical process, not through any kind of fuel optimization. In other words, the fuel would have had to come from non-physical source directed onto the physical plane by magician's focused intention. In my humble opinion. Next, numerous authorities have written on the subject of ever-burning lamps. W. Wynne Westcott, who, if you remember, we looked at a lot, he wrote the book on the Bimbine table. The best condensation of the meaning of that table. Anyway, he estimates the number of writers who have given the subject consideration at more than 150, HPB at 173. While conclusions reached by different authors are at variance, a majority admit the existence of these phenomenal lamps. So here are some examples of ever-burning lamps as described by HPB. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. And when scientists are told that the Romans preserved lights in their sepulchres for countless years by the oiliness of gold, and that one of such ever-burning lamps was found brightly burning in the tomb of Tullia, the daughter of Cicero, notwithstanding that the tomb had been shut up 1,550 years, they have a certain right to doubt and even disbelieve the statement until they assure themselves on the evidence of their own senses that such a thing is possible. One of such lamps is mentioned by the Reverend S. Matir of the London Mission in the Temple of Trivandrum in the Kingdom of Travancore, South India. There is a deep well inside the temple into which immense riches are thrown year by year, and in another place, in a hollow covered by a stone, a great golden lamp, which was lit over 120 years ago, still continues burning. Says this missionary in his description of the place, the Abihook was seen and examined one of such lamps, and so have other people, whose good luck it has been to win the confidence and friendship of Eastern lamas and divines. Isis unveiled.
Thank you, Barbara. Any thoughts or questions? I see a hand.
Yes, go ahead, Ariane.
Yes, there's, you know, when Jesus was a fourth degree initiate, his next lifetime was as Apollonius of Tyana. And There's a book by Lucius Philostratus of his life, traveling throughout basically Persia to India. Those are the myths of Jesus going to India. It's about his lifetime when he was a fifth degree initiate. Very much worth reading. And one of the stories is about a king who had access to some kind of mineral that was a flame that could not be put out, and he was using it in war. So I think there are, like different kinds of minerals that they could remain hot, they could remain glowing, they could remain on fire. We just don't know. I don't think it's just symbolic. I think that, luckily for our protection, we don't have access to that mineral. The king who was using it was digging it out from some kind of river, or like deep within the mud. And we know that there are myths like that, where there are flames that don't go out, like in the Hebrew myths about Hanukkah, in which the lamps don't go out. And maybe it's just symbolic, but also, who's to say that they're not minerals from other planets, or minerals that are brought in that we don't know of anymore? That's all. It may
Right.
seem very materialistic what I'm saying, but I just feel like
It's possible.
it could be.
Yeah, it's possible. I agree that it is possible. It's completely outside the purview of modern science. Because there's no fuel that could be optimized to that extent. Without some form of source, but. That, like I said before, that doesn't mean that there couldn't be an overshadowing that would I would think it would be a fairly easy thing, for instance, for Master Wisdom to do to if he found that there was any real purpose in doing it. That's where the question mark comes up for me, because like you said, it's such a physical phenomena. Is it really in this day and age, anyway, is it worth the effort? It's a form of miracle that can help quote unquote unbelievers, or foster that kind of faith. I see another hand.
Miss Barbara, please go ahead.
Yes, well, apparently the sun does not burn fuel but goes through nuclear fusion. And there are a group of scientists now that are trying to duplicate that as the best new source of energy. So it's not, it's an energy source that's not burning fuel in a way that we might think.
Couple of things about that are interesting. First of all, it's in a way symbolic of solar fire, right? Which is the fire of the second aspect, which, the sun, you could say, the physical sun isn't literally that solar fire, but it represents it for us. And of course, we don't have nuclear fusion yet as a practical means, certainly not, and its demonstration would not come as a candle, or a lamp as such, unless it was done through some miraculous means. Well, this has brought a lot of interest. So, you want to call on people?
Heliosol, go ahead, please.
Oh, I just arrived here, but it is very interesting episode, and I will have to read the whole book myself. But I want to bring the comparison of this to the tradition in Eastern Europe of eternal fire. Sometime in the memorials or some monuments dedicated, let's say, to the collective kind of like courage during the dedicated to the some monument that is Maybe there is some soldiers that have been, honorably like buried there or just memorial, and they actually, they don't have this antique ability to just maintain that fire like we are now discussing, but they pipe the gas line, and then they burn that fire from that gas source.
Right.
And it burns day and night and every weather. And it really, to me, feels like this is the eternal fire of the souls of the departed, because souls is eternal and the fire looks like eternal. I think this is also reminds me the fire of eternal knowledge that is never go away, no matter how much it's sometimes destructed or wiped or
Yeah.
hidden. And there is also the Agni. I dabbled into the Agni because I through my Vedic interest. And the Agni fire, and it's just so many references to that eternal fire in many aspects. And also, I'm not surprised that someone mentioned or that is could be maintained by some minerals or unknown materials to us from another worldly resources. And I would be interested to look into that too. And thank you so much. That's it.
Yeah, thank you. This is cross-cultural, big time. Even in very exoteric formats, you find this. The flame of the unknown soldier still burns. In this country, I think in Arlington Cemetery, they have a eternal flame, and I think it's everywhere. That you would find, because it's so easily to adapt the concept of an external flame to the idea of the spirit aspect of the flame of knowledge. So it's a natural metaphor. Okay, we still have hands.
Yes, and we've got a comment. Go ahead, Tia.
I was gonna say, I think about spirit inhabiting form, and it's not the other way around. Form doesn't inhabit spirit. Father impregnates mother. Mother does not impregnate father. So when we talk about anything that is immortal or that is eternal, we're talking about soul and the father aspect. It has to inhabit somehow. Even if it's a mineral from outer space, it has to have a divine aspect to it in order for it to have any kind of eternal or immortal aspect.
Thank you, Tia. I totally concur. It's just not of the physical realm to truly have that eternality as part of its quality. That's not possible. Now, I think it could be optimized, and I really do believe that it could be overshadowed, that if there was some particular purpose, that it could be informed by a demon, for lack of a better term, to keep an external flame lit. That would be magic, and that process. But at purely physical levels, maybe there is a substance, a rare substance somewhere or from another planet or whatever, but does that really forward our philosophy? It would just be some kind of optimal atomic structure that allowed for this. I don't actually find it all that important, that there be or not be such a substance. I think the importance comes in its relationship to the spirit aspect and its symbolism for the spirit aspect, and the possibility that, some being out of form could keep an eternal flame burning. That's just my feelings about it.
Francis?
Yeah.
Ben says modern batteries are primitive examples of power and fire storage. Because war is being fought over uranium and lithium, depriving them of their national assets by force and fear, we will not soon be led to fire rediscovery.
Oh, yeah, that's so true. Gosh. Yeah, thank you, Ben. Okay, next up, an extended description of these ever-burning lights, which, well, I didn't comment on these. I think it's more along the lines of discussion that we've already had, but it is worth reading because it's interesting. So let's get a reader for this, please.
Vivian, can you please read that for us?
Wonders of Antiquity continued. On this subject, the learned Jesuit Athanasius Kircher, usually dependable, exhibits a striking inconsistency. In his Oedipus Egyptiacus, he writes, not a few of these ever-burning lamps have been found to be the devices of devils. Three stars. And I take it that all the lamps found in the tombs of the Gentiles, dedicated to the worship of certain gods, were of this kind, not because they burned or have been reported to burn with a perpetual flame, but because probably the devil set them there, maliciously intending thereby to obtain fresh credence for a false worship. Close quotes. Having admitted that dependable authorities defend the existence of the ever-burning lamps and that even the devil lends himself to their manufacture, Kircher next declared the entire theory to be desperate and impossible and to be classed with perpetual motion and the philosopher's stone. Having already solved the problem to his satisfaction once, Kircher solves it again, but differently, in the following words, quote, in Egypt, there are rich deposits of asphalt and petroleum. What did these clever fellows, the priests, do then but connect an oil deposit by a secret duct with one or more lamps provided with wicks of asbestos? How could such lamps help burning perpetually? Three stars. In my opinion, this is the solution of the riddle of the supernatural everlastingness of these ancient lamps. Close quote. Montfaucon, in his Antiquities, agrees in the main with the later deductions of Kircher, believing the fabled perpetual lamps of the temples to be cunning mechanical contrivances. He further adds that the belief that lamps burned indefinitely in tombs was the result of the noteworthy fact that in some cases fumes resembling smoke poured forth from the entrances of newly opened vaults. Parties going in later and discovering lamps scattered about the floor assumed that they were the source of the fumes.
Okay. Like I said, I don't find it necessary to comment on this, but it's interesting information. Let's continue. Can we get another reader, please?
Yeah. Michelle, can you read for us, please?
Sure, let me expand this a little. There are several interesting stories concerning the discoveries of ever-burning lamps in various parts of the world. In a tomb on the Appian Way, which was opened during the papacy of Paul III, was found a burning lamp which had remained alight in a hermetical sealed vault for nearly 1600 years. According to the account written by a contemporary, a body, that of a young and beautiful girl with long golden hair, was found floating in an unknown transparent liquid and as well preserved as though death had occurred but a few hours before. But about the interior of the vault were a number of significant objects, which included several lamps, one of them alight. Those entering the sepulcher declared that the draft caused by the opening of the door blew out the light and the lamp could not be relighted. Kircher reproduces an epitaph, Tulliole filiae miae, supposedly found in the tomb, but which Mount Falcon declares never existed, the latter adding that although conclusive evidence was not found, the body was generally believed to be that of Tallulah, the daughter of Cicero. Ever-burning lamps have been discovered in all parts of the world, not only the Mediterranean countries, but also India, Tibet, China, and South America have contributed records of lights which burn continuously without fuel. The examples which followed were selected at random from the imposing list of perpetual lamps found in different ages. Plutarch wrote of a lamp that burned over the door of a temple to Jupiter Ammon. The priest declared that it had remained alit for centuries without fuel. Saint Augustine described a perpetual lamp guarded in a temple in Egypt, sacred to Venus, which neither wind nor water could extinguish. He believed it to be the work of the devil.
Okay, so interesting, but again, I don't think we need to comment further. But if you do have any thoughts or questions, feel free. Next, more examples of long or perpetually burning lamps. A reader, please.
Marianne, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Wonders of Antiquity. An ever-burning lamp was found at Edessa, or Antioch, during the reign of the Emperor Justinian. Was in a niche over the city gate, elaborately enclosed to protect it from the elements. The date upon it proved that the lamp had been burning for more than 500 years. It was destroyed by soldiers. During the early Middle Ages, a lamp was found in England, which had burned since the 3rd century after Christ. The monument containing it was believed to be the tomb of the father of Constantine the Great. The lantern of Pallas was discovered near Rome in AD 1401. It was found in the sepulchre of Pallas, son of Evander, immortalized by Virgil in his Aeneid. The lamp was placed at the head of the body and burned with a steady glow for more than 2,000 years. In AD 1550, on the island of Nessus, in the Bay of Naples, a magnificent marble vault was opened, in which was found a lamp still alight, which had been placed there before the beginning of the Christian era. Pausanias described a beautiful golden lamp in the Temple of Minerva, which burned steadily for a year without refueling or having the wick trimmed. The ceremony of filling the lamp took place annually, and time was measured by the ceremony. According to the Fama Fraternitatis, the crypt of Christian Rosencreutz, when opened 120 years after his death, was found to be brilliantly illuminated by a perpetual lamp suspended from the ceiling. Numa Pompilius, king of Rome and magician of considerable power, caused a perpetual light to burn in the dome of a temple he had created in honor of an elemental being.
Thank you, Ariane. Any thoughts or questions about this idea? I mean, there's a lot of examples here, right? It's just seems to be a very important element, especially in the ancient world. Okay, before we turn the page, let's take a look at the two illustrations. First, the base of the Delphian tripod. Can we get a reader, please?
Ben, Can you read that for us, please?
The base of the Delphian tripod. The windings of these serpents form the base, and the three heads sustain the 3 feet of the tripod. It is impossible to secure satisfactory information concerning the shape and the size of the celebrated Delphian tripod. Theories concerning it are based in the most part upon small ornamental tripods discovered in various temples.
Thank you, Ben. Ashley, the three-headed snake also makes up the esoteric caduceus as illustrated in the Secret Doctrine, which is associated with Hermes or Mercury and represents three aspects of electricity. this seems relevant to the possible purpose of the tripod, which might have been used to stabilize the potency that flowed through the oracle. The other illustration from Beaumont's Gleanings of Antiquities is called the Delphian Tripod Restored. I'm going to ask Aunt Veronica to read this. Is she still with us? Because there's some Greek involved. Let's see here. I thought there was, anyway.
Yes, I'll read it.
Okay.
I hope I don't butcher it, because sometimes I don't recognize the English names. They might be Greek, but I don't recognize.
Can you read these three?
Apollodoro Ierias, Apollodoros Priest, Ton Chariton, Διαβίου is for life, Ton Chariton, Charis, Grace, but I can't remember the. And the other one is upside down. I can't read the bottom one.
Right. Hang on. Let me turn it around for you.
Λευκίου, Γογλιαίου, Αυτού, Ιού. Oh, well, it's a name, actually.
Huh. Okay.
Λευκίου, Γογλιαίου, Αυτού, Ιού. That Λευκίος, Γογλιαίος made this, I think. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, thank you. We certainly wouldn't have known that much without you. Thank you. All right, let me get it going back in play mode here. Go ahead.
According to Beaumont, the above is the most authentic form of the Delphian tripod extant. But as the tripod must have changed considerably during the life of the oracle, hasty conclusions are unwise. In his description of the tripod, Beaumont divides it into four parts. One, a frame with three legs. Two, a reverberating basin or bowl set in the frame. Three, a flat plate or table upon which the Pythia sat. And four, a cone-shaped cover over the table which completely concealed the priestess, and from beneath which her voice sounded forth in weird and hollow tones. Attempts have been made to relate the Delphian tripod with a Jewish Ark of the Covenant. The frame of the three legs was linked to the Ark of the Covenant. The flat plate or table of the mercy seat and the cone-shaped covering of the tent of the tabernacle itself. This entire conception differs widely from that popular accepted, but discloses a valuable analogy between Jewish and Greek symbolism.
Thank you, Aunt Veronica. Okay, first, according to Beaumont, the above is the most authentic form of the Delphian tripod extant. But as the tripod must have changed considerably during the life of the oracle, hasty conclusions are unwise. So here's John Beaumont's Gleanings of Antiquities, which contains the plate reproduced by MPH. with a caption under the image stating, "This tripod was found in the ruins of Delphos." The statement is incorrect, as MPH here seems to suspect. In fact, the original tripod has never been found. There was much less scholarship during this period, 16th century, and a lot of fancy was written as fact during these early ideas, when these ideas were initially written. Okay, next. In his description of the tripod, Beaumont divides it into four parts. One, a frame with three legs. Two, a reverberating basin or bowl set in the frame. Three, a flat plate or table upon which the Pythia sat. And four, a cone-shaped cover over the table, which completely concealed the priestess, and from beneath which her voice sounded forth in a weird and hollow tones. This is pure fancy. Antiquarian writers of Beaumont's era often relied on hearsay, travelers' reports, or imaginative reconstruction rather than any kind of systematic archaeology, which didn't even exist as a discipline when Gleanings of Antiquity was written. Finally, attempts have been made to relate the Delphian tripod with the Jewish Ark of the Covenant. The frame of three legs was likened to the Ark of the Covenant, the flat plate or table to the mercy seat, and the cone-shaped covering to the tent of the tabernacle itself. This entire conception differs widely from that popularly accepted, but discloses a valuable analogy between Jewish and Greek symbolism. MPH here proposes a symbolic correspondence between the Delphic tripod and the Ark of the Covenant, with the tripod's three legs compared to the supporting frame of the Ark, its flat plate to the mercy seat where the divine presence was believed to manifest, and its cone-shaped covering to the tabernacle's tent that enclosed the sacred space. The idea is that both traditions express the same archetype, a sacred vessel or structure designed to mediate and contain the presence of the divine. And at that level, it works. Any kind of cause-effect relationship is very doubtful, but there is, you know, an analogous, the purpose of both vessels can be seen to be contiguous, that they both suggest the idea of a spirit in formed objects, right? Okay, the other illustrations page depicts a three-headed coiled serpent, and it is followed and has the caption that we read already. There is no evidence supporting the idea that this sculpture supported the Delphian tripod, but miraculously, this coiled three-headed serpent was removed from Delphi and taken to Constantinople in ancient times, where it still stands. There it is, the actual original object, which I find really extraordinary that it survived. And here's, this is one of the heads of this serpent, which looked like this. So it's actually an archaeological object that just lends credence to the idea that these objects existed in Delphi, right? Well, folks, you know what? This is the time we normally end, and if you would, and we're gonna end it as normal with giving the dates for future events. But I'm also gonna keep going. So even BL, if you need to take off, that's fine. And I'm just gonna, I have just a little bit more that I've prepared. And so that, and that will do it for this series. So first of all, as I said before, this is the last Secret Teachings of All Ages. Though it pains me because I love this material. But, and this is a big but, there's going to be a really great new series starting up in its place, which is The Light of the Soul, which was co-written by DK and Alice Bailey. And I'm really excited. It's basically the science of how to close the gap between personality and soul, step by step, as you know, the ageless wisdom presented it, and it was collated by Patanjali, brought into a singular form. And so I hope you'll join me for that. That'll be the first Sunday of January. And other dates, BL?
Okay, the secret doctrine, we've got it. It's going to be next week. We had to rearrange due to the heavy Advent schedule. So Secret Doctrine next week, 14th of December at 8 p.m. Then the next Treatise on Cosmic Fire will be the 12th of December.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, so yeah, this always happens in the holidays, you know, that we have a shifting around. Also, you might want to join us for the beginning of the Mori Federation school year. There's going to be five of us that speak for just a few minutes each about different topics. And I think that will be announced in the normal
yes,
the mailings that come out. So yeah,
and might, it'll also be announced on campus and everything. We're tentatively working on a date of the solstice, but again, we've got a lot of heavy stuff going on, so we have to deconflict. But yeah, we'll get the word out as soon as we have it firmed, date, time, and all that. So hope to see you there.
Okay. Actually, I've changed my mind. Let me look at the chats here. See if there's, I'm seeing a couple of, yeah, okay, a couple of thank yous. I'm not going to go ahead. I'm just looking at the material, and it's very much like what we read earlier about. It just focuses in on the wicks that were used in these lamps. And, you know, moderns who have, you know, tried to create wicks that would last a long time, that kind of thing. But I think we got the gist of this idea of the eternal lamp. So kind of a fun note to end on, end the series on. So we'll see you hopefully for the Secret Doctrine, which is next Sunday rather than its usual time. So thank you all. Much love. Be well.
Goodbye, everybody. Thanks, Francis. Loved, loved, loved this series.
Thank you so much. So much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you, Francis.
You're welcome, everyone.